I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. On June 5th, 2013, the Salvation Army thrift store at 22nd and Market in Philadelphia collapsed, killing 7 people and injuring 12. It was a shocking tragedy, the result of a demolition project next door gone horribly wrong. The contractor and excavator operator are in prison, and last week there was a settlement in the civil trial that lasted for 17 weeks, $227 million to be paid by the Salvation Army and the building owner speculator Richard Bassiano. Our guest Nancy Winkler lost her daughter Anne Bryan in that collapse and with her husband has worked to make sure that something like this never happens again. She is a municipal financial expert, served as city treasurer under the Nutter administration. And Nancy Winkler, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. The most obvious question is, how are you doing?
I guess I'm doing as well as somebody could do under the set of circumstances that we have been dealt. So thanks for asking.
Absolutely. And it's such a sad thing to talk about, but such an important thing as well.
Yeah.
You actually brought in these notebooks that you kept during both the criminal trial and the civil trial.
Yes, I did.
Two trials that you attended. Did you attend every day?
I attended the criminal trial every single day, and as you mentioned, the civil trial started, I believe it was on September 19th. I missed one day to attend a funeral of one of my college roommate's husband, and I stepped out for part of a day to attend a doctor's appointment. But other than that, yes, I was there. Every single day, I got there in the morning, and I tried to stay. I did stay till the end, and often after the jury left in the evening, there so that I could hear and learn about the, you know, the legal motions that were happening when the jury was not in the room.
Were you there in part to bear witness for your daughter, or there to understand how this horrible thing could happen?
Yeah, I originally felt that I needed to be there to bear witness. That was my sort of driving idea. Right. And as I specifically, I think even more for the civil trial than for the criminal trial, because the criminal trial was very narrow. They only were trying a single person. The excavator operator, Sean Benscop, had pled guilty to lesser charges. And the demolition contractor, Griffin Campbell, was the only individual criminally charged. So that was a very narrow set of facts that were presented. But it was a much, much more complicated set of facts and realities that led up to this collapse than what was presented in the criminal trial. So I wanted to understand that because I felt that if I really did understand it, it would be something, one less thing I would have to deal with trying to think about what happened or and feeling like I never really would understand it. And the truth be told, you can't capture in a few newspaper articles or short reporting on TV or radio the complexities of what occurred in the courtroom. And by being there, I was able to, I think, understand why the jury found what they found.
Sure. Do you understand? And I read a long piece about you and your husband and your daughter and what happened in Philadelphia Magazine. And one of the things you say in that was this was not an accident. I mean, an accident is something that just goes wrong for unforeseen reasons. This was a tragedy waiting to happen.
It was a tragedy waiting to happen. And, you know, in the summer of 2013, I guess it was June 5th when the building collapsed. Yeah. And within, I believe it was an incredibly short period of time, days, they had charged a single individual, Sean Benscop, with various criminal charges associated with this collapse.
And he was operating.
He was operating it, and it was explained to me that he had apparently had smoked some marijuana in the morning, and somehow I felt that just couldn't be the whole story. There was even in this was before we'd even buried Ann. To be told, oh, it's this one guy with a, you know, it just made no sense to me. And so I really, from that moment on, felt, uh-oh, people are looking for a simple answer here, and that's not going to be right. Mm-hmm. And these sorts of things should never happen anywhere in the world, but certainly not in, you know, one of the largest cities in America, in where we know how to demolish a building safely. And everything we know was ignored.
Well, I was going to say everything I read about it, including a lot of the critiques, including yours, was that just about everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong, and mistakes just on almost every single level.
I would say one of the things that I learned during the civil trial that was particularly, I have to say, shocking to me, and maybe it was available publicly before this time, but I don't think I had been able to focus on it, was that there were individuals in the community not associated with the developer, Richard Bassiano, and STB, his corporation, not related to the Salvation Army, just individuals who were taking photographs and videos because it was so outrageous what was happening on the site. And they were taking these photographs and videos starting, I think, about May 15th.
So about a couple weeks beforehand.
Yeah.
When it was clear.
More than a couple weeks.
Right.
And there was a very seasoned, very experienced union carpenter who was on the roof of the Mutter Museum, who took photos daily and reported it to OSHA. And those photos all were presented to the jury. There were people who were taking videos. And somehow everything went wrong.
Well, we're talking about OSHA. I guess we're talking about L&I. I mean, we're talking about various, I guess, departments within government, whether local government or federal government. There was even a member of L&I who committed suicide after this case, sort of believing, I guess, in some degree that he was responsible for what had happened. You just gave me a look. Maybe not.
I can't.
You can't.
I can't. To me, when you sort of start to talk about single individuals, you're really heading in the wrong direction when you want to think about what went wrong and to think about what needs to change. and I think it was very clear to the city immediately that some of the systems that were in place to check the private sector, because remember, this was a private sector developer running a demolition, the building next door was privately owned. And so in a way, really, we look to the private sector to have a set of standards for themselves about how they will conduct their business that is safe. And we have a right to expect that. And you want to be able to walk out of your house every day and know that basic known safety processes are being followed, or else we would have complete mayhem. And so the question is the checks and balances, and what are the systems that were not working, and trying to figure out that and try to figure out how to put those checks and balances in so that in the future this will never happen again.
Why do you think they weren't followed? I mean, why do you think some of these checks and balances, some of the sort of
of
demolition?
I think what was presented to the jury in the civil trial was very compelling. The developer, Richard Bassiano, testified that he had never selected anyone, any contractor in his career, except on the basis of a low bid. They evaluated whether or not they had taken any real effort to examine what the underlying qualifications were of the individuals who were directly involved in the demolition. And it was clear that no one from the project manager at STB to the architect.
That was Bassiano's company or that's Bassiano's
yes.
company. Yep.
To the architect Plato Marinakis, to Griffin Campbell, had ever been trained or involved in managing a demolition project of this complexity. It was a four-story building. The old Hoagie right. City building was a four-story building, and the Salvation Army building was a one-story building, you know, next door. So and the basic concept of how you take a building down is you take it – I've learned this now, but it makes total sense. You take it down in the reverse order of how it was built. You take it down – so if you build, you know, the foundation and sure. then the first floor, second floor, third floor, et cetera, you take it down the same way, a masonry building like this.
And so, this was obviously not done. There was a piece yesterday in the Philadelphia Inquirer, an interview with one of the jurors, Sarita Harrison. She also had some comments about Bassiano. I'm going to quote here, who left the witness stand in tears after testifying he was heartbroken about the injuries and loss of life. Harrison said his testimony, quote, did not add up. I just felt like, and the Oscar goes to, as if it were some kind of a performance. And then she makes a reference to always going for the lowest bidder. She says that's okay when you're buying a birthday cake, but that's not okay when doing demolition.
Yeah.
Kind of speaking to exactly what you said.
I just like to say another reason why I wanted to be in the courtroom every day was I wanted to put a face on the tragedy, the victims. I wanted to be there for my daughter Anne and for the other people who were killed on June 5th and for those who were injured as well. I was really the only person who came every single day. My daughter had her best friend with her, and her best friend was also killed, Mary Simpson. And Mary's mom was able to come a couple days a week, and right. so she was there. But I felt that I wanted the jurors to know there were people who were hurting. And I have to tell you, I didn't like to stare at the jurors, but I certainly studied them when I thought it was okay. And they seemed incredibly engaged, and they seemed they paid attention. They had to sit through weeks and weeks and weeks of
17 weeks.
Yes, of testimony. Some of it gripping, and frankly, some of it with architectural or engineering experts, and long periods of arguing back and forth between the plaintiffs and the defense attorneys about arcane legal issues, and they really. I was inspired to see that six regular human beings listening to the facts, paying attention, reached the verdict that we would have hoped and thought was right.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Nancy Winkler. We are talking about the collapse of the Salvation Army thrift store a couple of years ago where she lost her daughter, Anne Bryan. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Nancy Winkler. She's a former Philadelphia City Treasurer. She is a municipal financial expert, and tragically, her daughter was killed in the collapse of the Salvation Army thrift store that happened June 5th, 2013. This was really a shocking tragedy. There was a criminal trial, a civil trial, a verdict, and a settlement last week, and we've been talking about some of the experiences that she had being in the courtroom, and also we'll be talking a bit about some of the reforms that she and her husband have been working for. And I do want to talk about her daughter as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, I'd love our listeners and frankly myself to know a little bit about your daughter, Anne Bryan. She was how old when
she
died?
So Anne was 24 when she was killed. I always try to say she was killed.
Yeah.
And, how do you capture a person and how do you capture a young person who has really reached that point in their life where they're beginning to pull together all their different qualities and strengths and weaknesses and find, you know, a direction and purpose in their life, but haven't yet really been able to then pursue their dreams now that they've shaped them. Well, Anne was a very unusual person. You know, in many ways, she marched to the beat of her own drummer. She had a pretty complicated set of skills and talents, and she was very, very, very loving and sort of passionate, very joyful person. She was a wonderful friend and a devoted sister and daughter. So we had a very close family. She was very friendly to just people, children, old people. She had this sort of personal sense of herself that she wanted whenever she encountered someone, a stranger, a person on the street, in a shop, she wanted to make sure that she made them feel good. And so she—
That's extraordinary.
It was quite a skill. So she would give a little smile and say something nice. And, you know, she was a very, very good listener. She was very fully present in the way she interacted with anyone that she was interacting with. And I think that meant that she formed these very strong relationships with people. And, you know, she had interest in social justice and I think originally thought she was going to go into some aspect of her of a career. People used to tease her at high school that she was going to be become a reporter for NPR.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But she also was extremely interested in the arts and had was a singer, was often cast in a lead role in the high school plays, and also had the visual art skills. Mm-hmm. So she wound up at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts as a student, hoping to get a joint major in painting and sculpture, and then thought maybe she would want to go into maybe psychotherapy using her art skills.
Wow. I mean, what an extraordinary person.
Well, she
young
was,
woman.
She was, and it's a loss. It's a loss to us.
It sounds like
a loss
to
all
of us.
Us.
This is such a – I'm not sure if this is a fair or unfair question. Obviously, this verdict, this settlement was large by – certainly by urban city standards. Does that in any way feel like justice to you? Does it feel as if justice was done for your daughter and the others who were killed and those who were injured, including some who were just so seriously injured in this collapse?
So when I took about a month off from work when Anne was killed. And when I came back, one of my colleagues in the city, who's a very thoughtful person, you know, came to see me and said to me, if you think you're going to get justice, don't heal by planning on getting justice, because you can never get justice in something like this. You know, try to find some other ways to channel your grief. No, there's money. You can never replace what we've lost. I do think, especially because of the truncated nature of the criminal trial, and it was incredibly important, not just for the victims, but I think as a matter of public interest and public policy, for there to be a public examination of everything that led up to this, which is what the civil trial really allowed. And that public exposure, I think, I think that was part of the justice process, the simply everybody understanding now much, much better than they did prior to the trial what happened. So I think that serves – that is part of justice.
And the airing of all this information for people to digest, understand, hopefully use to make changes.
I think it hopefully will – I think there are a lot of things that have happened as a result of this. One of the things that we've wanted to do is to make sure this never happens again. And of course, how do you do that?
Right.
You create the history so there's a story so it can be told you seek reforms in terms of the governmental oversight, and you try to put a physical reminder out there to the public. And so one of the things that I felt very passionate about from the very beginning was that we needed to create a memorial where a memorial park on the site, and with the hope that that memorial park would be an enduring reminder to everyone in the city of Philadelphia about what happened, that human life was second to development in that circumstance, and that we should never allow that to happen again. And I'm hopeful that there can be a way for many of us to find uses to program that park, to constructively share the story and inspire us to be better.
You know, looking at the number of people that were killed that day and also injured, it felt like the world was there. I mean, they're representing so many different parts of the city, the region, obviously your daughter as well, but people from other countries and other backgrounds, all either shopping or working at the thrift store.
That's right. And that was, I think a lot of people felt that way. One of the things I did in trying to build support and momentum for the Memorial Park was I launched a change.org petition to Mayor Nutter and Council President Clark calling for the creation of the Memorial Park. And that petition system allows people to write in. And there were many, many things people said, but one of the most common things people said was, that could have been me.
Yeah.
And those notes came from all over. People, I've heard from so many people who have said to me, that could have been me.
Happened to be shopping that day,
yeah.
or all of that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Nancy Winkler, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, talking about this tragic and shocking tragedy, June 5th, 2013, the collapse of the Salvation Army thrift store. It was part of a demolition project next door that, frankly, just went horribly wrong. Just about everything that was done incorrectly. There was a criminal trial, a civil trial as well, and last week a settlement from the civil trial. And we're talking about her daughter, who was lost in that collapse, and also efforts to improve and reform things like L&I and regulations and oversight. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, there's a comment here from Mike. What did the Salvation Army do in this case? And it looks like they have the sort of lion's share of covering this $227 million settlement. But how do you see their role in this tragedy?
Well, what was presented in the civil trial was, first, everything that was going wrong on the demolition side, and then the months and months and months of communication that were going on between the Salvation Army and the developer about the need to cooperate between the two of them because of a shared wall and because of the fact that the Salvation Army had, while it was a one-story building, they had built a four-story chimney and attached their chimney to the wall of the what was called the Hoagie City building. And I think what the jury concluded was that the Salvation Army was being given these increasingly, I would say, aggressive warnings that people might be killed, that people could be killed, there would be disasters, that no one would want to read the headlines. And they internally made a decision and apparently wrote this in internal emails, that they would never make a deal. And although they seemed to indicate in other emails to the developer that they could work something out. And it was but everything was just at a deadlock. They weren't getting along with one another. And what became clear is that the building became more and more unstable in the last few weeks. And although the Salvation Army sent an architect out to look at it, who took photographs, and the architect wrote them a fairly lengthy report back saying there was demolition going on at the site and that certain steps needed to be taken, none of those steps were taken. And
to protect the building or protect the people that
pedestrians coming into the store, to protect the roof, which of course would have then hopefully protected the people under the roof. So I think also there was a – I think – and the juror alluded to this in her comments to the reporter in the Inquirer. There was a sense that the upper command did not alert the people working in the store or empower the people working in the store about this demolition. They did not let them know that they had received these threatening emails about people being killed, and they did not ask them to report what was going on. And supposedly there – well, and the regional store manager came and testified that he was there at the store the day before the collapse, parked his car in front, and – he drove this extremely – he claimed to have driven this very bizarrely contorted way to the store so that he would never have seen the demolition next door. Wow. And it just – I'm guessing that for the jury, it didn't add up.
Let me ask you a couple of other questions before we have to say goodbye to you. And one – this has to do with the architect Plato Marinakos. You have actually filed with a licensing board to have his license revoked.
Yes, that's
Why
right.
Why did you do that?
So in November of 2015, my husband, John Bryan, and I filed a request to have his license revoked because an architect's number one duty is to protect the public safety. And public safety was not protected by this man. He was there all the time taking photographs. And he must have taken hundreds of photographs. He was there up to the night before the collapse, and he personally testified that he knew it was dangerous and he did not do anything, even knowing how unstable the situation was the night before, to alert the public and the city to get over there and close the store. And we feel that that was outrageous, and the jury found that it was outrageous. And we were distraught when he was given immunity by the prosecutor and by the district attorney's office. And we feel he should have been included in the criminal process. And this is really one of the only avenues that we have. And I think it is important to protect the public going forward.
This was in 2015. It's now the beginning of 2017. Any response from the licensing board to your request?
We have not gotten any response from the licensing board, although we recently heard that they may be seeking to obtain the records, the written testimony, the testimony in the civil trial. Mm-hmm. And so we are hopeful that they will see – they will thoroughly examine this and take the appropriate action.
I know that one of the things that you and your husband want are reforms to L&I, more regulation, more oversight. I know you went and looked at other cities to see what other cities are doing. Are you satisfied that there has been progress on this front?
Yes. We called for an independent panel to take a look at the reforms that were implemented in the summer of 2013. I will say immediately after the collapse, Mayor Nutter implemented some immediate reforms, and then City Council implemented additional reforms. But we felt that there were additional things that might be needed, and it was important to have an outside entity look at it. It wasn't a perfect process, but we had nationally known experts look and compare the City of Philadelphia to other cities around the country. And the most glaring difference between Philadelphia and other cities was that we're the only major city and even moderate-sized city in the country, it's my understanding, that does not have a separate department of buildings.
Wow.
And they called for the separation of the public safety function, the evaluation of demolition and building safety to be separated from the permitting of restaurants and bars and that sort of thing. And then they made a set of 11 recommendations. That was their number one recommendation. The second one, which we had called for, was that the department be led by a licensed professional engineer or building safety expert. And I have to say, while the exact recommendations as set forth have not been implemented, and it's been very slow, we are seeing some important changes occur. I'd like to thank everyone in the city who's focused on this, and also at the same time ask that we all continue to stay focused on it, because even the folks in the department and in the citizen oversight board that's in place that's monitoring, they will acknowledge that they have a long, long way to go before they will be satisfied that we actually have the quality of building safety enforcement that the citizens of Philadelphia deserve and expect.
Well, I thank you for what you're doing for the city. I am so sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry that that loss is connected with the work that you're doing, but obviously making a great big difference. Nancy Winkler, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Nancy Winkler talking about the collapse of the Salvation Army thrift store. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And do stay with us, an interview with Joshua Johnson after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. This Wednesday, Radio Times becomes an hourly show, airing weekdays from 10 until 11. A new program from WAMU and NPR will have its Philly debut at 11. It's called 1A, a live public affairs program about the issues of the day, not unlike Radio Times, but from a national perspective. It's hosted by Joshua Johnson, who I interviewed last week. He's got a couple of ties to the region, and he's got big plans for the program. Well, Joshua Johnson, welcome to Radio Times. Welcome to WHYY, and welcome back to Philadelphia. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be back.
In fact, you did a summer intern program at our sister station, WRTI. What was that about?
Well, I did a summer program at Temple University. It was before I had made the decision to go into radio, but WRTI has a lot to do with me being in radio now. I was in a program at the Temple University School of Medicine called the MARC program, Minority Access to Research Careers Program, which was run by Dr. Moses Williams at the time. And it was for students of color who might be interested in careers in medical research. We would spend the summer working in a lab, shadowing a clinician. I worked in the Saul Sherry Thrombosis Lab at the medical school, and then spending time at Temple University Hospital doing clinical rotations, just kind of shadowing doctors as they do what they do. And I got to see emergency medicine, I got to see obstetrics, I got to see surgery, ophthalmology, sports medicine, many different departments. But while we were there, and my mother was also there working in the program, she's a school librarian, so she was teaching research skills. While we were there in the program and living on campus at Temple, she discovered this thing called National Public Radio from listening to WRTI, which played news and jazz at the time. And so she tuned in for the jazz. And then at 4 o'clock, she heard this guy named Robert Siegel on All Things Considered.
Know him well,
And it just hooked her. And she got me hooked. So if we had not spent those summers in Philadelphia doing something very different than radio, I might never have ended up sitting where I am now.
You'd be doing medical research. So what hooked you?
I think it was just the kind of storytelling, that it was much more immersive. It appealed to my inner geek in that it got into a whole lot of topics about a whole lot of things. It also appealed to my love of the arts. I wanted to be a performer or an actor long before I ever wanted to be a doctor or a journalist, although I was always interested in broadcast journalism. And so just the craft of storytelling, the art of spinning a yarn, is very present in the way that public radio does what it does. And so the confluence of all of those things really appealed to me, even as a 13, 14, 15-year-old kid.
Were you one of those kids that talked into a hairbrush handle as a form of a microphone?
I believe mine was a stick.
Oh, it was a stick. Okay.
Off the ground. My family members swear that we went to a reunion one year up in the Jacksonville, Florida area. My family's from South Florida. And at one point in the reunion, there was a big gathering, and I was walking around from person to person saying something to the effect of, "Excuse me, I'm Joshua Johnson, and I just wanted to ask you, who are you voting for?" And I went from person to person, just interviewing them one by one. And my mother, of course, was like, "Boy, quit messing with dough." And the grown folks were nice. They were like, "Nah, leave that boy alone. He ain't hurt nobody. Go ahead. Interview me. Come talk to me." And so I was always encouraged to do that, even though sometimes it led to some unintentional comedy. But generally, people just kind of knew that I always had an affinity for this, and they encouraged it.
Well, it sounds like it led to 1A, your new show. I'm sure there were a lot of names that you considered. Why 1A?
1A is the First Amendment. So it's the backbone of how we can do what we're doing now and how we kind of express ourselves as a society. It's, if you think about it, the First Amendment is kind of the basic rules of the road for engaged citizenship. It gives us a blueprint, or it lays the beginnings of a blueprint for how we talk to one another, how we demand change from the government, how we connect with the divine, with the eternal. And it's just kind of a day-to-day basic rules of the road. And so naming a program after the First Amendment, to me, makes all the sense in the world. Also, my first radio job was in Miami in a partnership with the Miami Herald. And the Miami Herald calls the front page of its paper page 1A. And those are the kinds of stories we want to focus on. Those stories like the ones you see above the fold that are the necessities that everyone needs to talk about and needs to talk about well and deeply and intelligently. And then the stories below the fold that may not be the top news, but they're interesting, they're worthy, they may be buzzworthy, the kinds of things that people are talking about or ought to be talking about that just help connect us as a community. So it's kind of a dual meaning.
You have taken over a slot that Diane Rehm held for 37 years. What of her show have you wanted to retain, and what do you want to change?
Well, Diane and I actually have a lot in common. We both are big believers in the potential of public radio. We're both very curious about the world. We're both very devoted to civil conversation. We are both highly, highly allergic to double talk, and we are both very excited about the potential for public radio to reach audiences that it typically does not reach. I think what we want to retain from the Diane Rehm Show are those core journalistic tenets, the things that are really the most important about how we do our journalism and the way that we talk to people and the respect that we show everyone who comes into our studio. What we change is the sound, the feel, the way we pick topics, the team that we have. You know, we have two producers from the Diane Rehm Show who are working on 1A. And then we hired a larger team of people who come from all over public media and different parts of the country to be a part of this show. We use audience feedback differently. For instance, we don't take live calls in every show.
I noticed that.
We will take live calls. Yeah, and some people have asked, why don't you take live calls anymore? And then other people have said, thank goodness you don't take live calls anymore.
I've heard that too.
And exactly. And what we found, allowing people to primarily leave us voicemails allows us to curate the best comments.
I read that you have said this about who you think you are on the radio, not necessarily a journalist, but a citizen. First of all, why not a journalist and why a citizen?
Well, not just a journalist. I don't come into my work from a partisan perspective. I leave my politics at the door as much as I can. But it helps remind me that I not only have the privilege of doing this work, but I, as a citizen, have the responsibility, whether I'm a journalist or not, to question authority and to engage with my fellow citizens so that together we can try to do what's right.
We've been playing some of the promos for your new show, and you talk about a program based on fact, not accusation. And as we all know, we live in a world where people seem to have their own facts, live in kind of walled off factual communities. How do you propose to either break down those walls or climb over those walls or invite people over the wall into a different space?
Well, let me break that into two pieces, one about facts and one about invitation. I'll start with the invitation piece because I think that one's a little more tricky. Mm-hmm. I think it's our responsibility to make sure that 1A and public radio as much as possible is a space that is as welcoming as possible for everyone, that we are a safe space for people to be heard. We immediately stand out compared to everything else out there because we're not a place where people tend to come with clenched fists and sharp elbows. We would rather they come to us with open arms and treat one another with a baseline of respect. Doesn't mean you got to agree with everybody, but you have to at least recognize the humanity in the people across the table from you, or we can't have this conversation. And that's part of our responsibility to choose topics that reflect the needs of wide swaths of the American people, to check our assumptions and our biases in everything that we do, to try to ask questions that allow all sides to stake their case clearly and to argue their cases robustly without feeling like they're being beaten down. And a lot of that just falls on me, to not come into the studio and be nasty to one side or the other, but just to treat everyone with the same respect that I would want. That's the invitation part. In terms of facts, you don't get to pick your facts. No one does. The facts are the facts.
How do you prepare for a show? And I realize you're not new to radio, but your show is a little more than a month old. What are the kind of preparations, exercises, all of that, that you do in order to be your fresh self on the air?
Other than sleep.
Which is always good and always needed.
Always good. Other than, well, and seriously, I think the first thing I try to do is just take care of my body. Like, I try to get a decent amount of sleep. I drink water all day long. You know, I don't drink. I don't smoke. There's a gym across the street from the radio station, which is wonderful. I'm a member and I go as often as I can. Like, I just try to take care of myself physically, because if your body is weak, your mind will follow. You can't have one be strong and the other be weak. So I just try to take care of myself. Our production team helps with booking guests and conceptualizing programs and taking the first pass at writing the script and questions. So that part is kind of taken care of more by the production team, and then I help in the editorial process. I try to read as much as I can, but a lot of it is just the front end, you know, conceptualizing the show at the beginning.
And so what's a good show to you? When the hour is over and you say, damn, that was good. What is that?
I think a good show, well, first of all, I try not to say that because I don't want to get up my own ego, and I will. I will walk out of there like, Johnson, you killed it. And I try not to do that. And it's like, radio, microphone of the year award goes to, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, something less than that. But yes, I know what you're talking about.
I think that a good hour of radio is one that makes me feel like we've gone someplace people don't typically go in terms of what people expect from public radio. We're enjoying defying people's expectations about what we are and what we can do and whose voices we can reflect. I think it's a show ultimately that does something for you that you cannot do for yourself, that answers questions from people you don't have access to in your own life, that coalesces information in ways that you might not have access to in your own life, that views the world through a perspective that may be broader than yours, not better, just broader than yours, that you can benefit from. I think our function in radio, with our access to the huge network we have in Washington, is to leverage that in ways that help people uniquely. And I think that if we continue to reify our unique function in people's lives, then they'll understand why they need us. They'll understand why they need all the different programs from public radio that they receive. So I think that's my main goal, just to make sure people know what they gain from us every single day and what they would miss if we were gone.
I read that your partner has a barbershop, perhaps a barbershop in San Francisco. I'm not sure if he's moved east with you or not, but barbershops are where the best conversations take place. Yes?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Hard to compete with that, right?
It is hard to compete with that. He's still in San Francisco, and he is a native Philadelphian.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, he grew up in Plymouth Meeting.
So oh,
he grew
sure.
up right out, yeah, right in the area. And his family is still there. We have family who works at Drexel. And so we're very steeped in that area. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in black barbershops just listening to people cut to fool and and talk loud and draw a crowd and say whatever they thought and then argue it out and laugh. And it was just great to kind of see the dynamic culturally. And I think that's one of those things that kind of stuck with me in radio long before the advent of Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, social media, is that people don't need us to have these conversations. They're going to have them anyway. Our job is to add to the conversation. We're not the conversation, but if we can be a useful supplement, if we can be an enhancement to the conversations people are already having, then that's where we rock, if we can just add to what people are already doing.
I've been hosting radio for 30 years, and there's something that happens a couple of times a year where I have these radio hosting nightmares, not unlike the nightmares I had when I was in school where I forgot to study for the exam and all of a sudden there it is and I can't find the book and I'm not wearing any clothes and
exactly.
all of that. You haven't been on the air that long, although I know you've done radio for some time now. Have you had any radio hosting nightmares yet?
Oh, mercifully, no. I used to have Morning Edition nightmares when I was the morning newscaster
really?
At KQED in San Francisco. Oh, yes. I'm due on the air at 5 a.m. I arrive at like 4:43. My key card doesn't work. Then someone finally lets me in, and the power's been out, so the computers are still rebooting. I don't recognize any of the equipment. The audio board is the old analog board and not the digital board. The scripts aren't finished being written. They're playing music. We can't even get Morning Edition. We can't get the feed, and I have to just wing it. So I've had that nightmare before. I think the difference now is I feel, first of all, I'm not getting up at 3:30 in the morning, and just that sleep schedule
that
just really messes with your brain. But other than that, I feel a lot less, I feel a very different kind of pressure in this position. You know, 1A is a new show, and no matter what we do, some people are going to say, well, you're no Diane Rehm. I wish Diane would come back. This is not what I expected them to replace a legend like Diane Rehm with. Some people are going to say that no matter what. Now, the nice thing is Diane Rehm is now doing a weekly podcast. So for those people who want to hear her, you still can. But I came into this knowing there are some people we will never, ever impress. And that's okay. It's not our job to impress this person or that person. It's our job to serve. It's our job to be creative and to try to grow this medium. And that means you have to be willing to make mistakes. You have to be willing to fall flat on your face from time to time. You have to be willing to take a bunch of layups and maybe only shoot 40% for a while. It's part of the process.
Well, Joshua Johnson, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times, and we look forward to hearing you Wednesday, the 15th of February, starting at 11 o'clock. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's show, and Radio Times produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, with Susan Greenbaum helping us out today. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.